The date is October 9th, 1987, and we're watching The Princess Bride. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me, as always, is the Fezzik to my Inigo Montoya.
Anybody want the peanut? Hello, I'm Colin Stewart.
So this week, we are looking back at October 1987, when the movies in theaters were Hellraiser, Fatal Attraction, The Pickup Artist, Amazon Women on the Moon, and of course, our movie for today, The Princess Bride, which earned $30.9 million on a $16 million budget. I didn't realize that with how popular The Princess Bride is with people that I know, I was shocked to realize that it didn't even double its budget.
Yeah, it's crazy because it wasn't a box office success. But it has like a 97% on Rotten Tomatoes, and I don't know a single person who doesn't like The Princess Bride.
Exactly.
So, yeah. And even though it would be inconceivable that if you're listening to this podcast that you haven't watched this movie, if for some odd reason you haven't seen this movie, there will be spoilers ahead, so please hit pause, go watch it for God's sakes, and then come back and hear what we have to say.
That's right. We love The Princess Bride, and we have saved this for our big episode 50 celebration. We decided we couldn't just throw The Princess Bride in on any episode number. This had to be one of those special occasion episodes, episode 50. Colin and I are both dressed up in our tuxedos. We're all ready for this 50th episode celebration.
Rolling out the red carpet. Cue the noise of champagne bottles popping off.
That's right. So the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, oh boy, I've got a shit ton again. Number one, we've got the story of a man and a woman who lived happily ever after, even though the courtship almost killed them.
That sounds more like Mr. and Mrs. Smith to me than The Princess Bride.
Maybe a little bit. And really, the courtship, I feel, was what happened in the beginning before there was any threat of death anyway. But, yeah. I mean, I see where they're going with it. Number two, we've got she gets kidnapped, he gets killed, but it all ends up okay.
I'm starting to see why maybe people didn't rush out to watch this movie in the theaters.
Yeah, it feels like it might have been marketed a little bit badly. I also just don't understand about... spoiler alert, he gets killed right there in the tagline, right? Third, I've got heroes, giants, villains, miracle men, true love, not just your basic, average, everyday, ordinary, run-of-the-mill, ho-hum fairy tale.
That one's decent. It explains a little bit too much, but
yeah,
still.
It reminds me kind of back when we did Christmas Story, where it was the good old-fashioned American Christmas. There was that really big, long tagline that kind of reminds me of that one.
Mm-hmm.
Fourth, we've got scaling the cliffs of insanity, battling rodents of unusual size, facing torture in the pit of despair, true love has never been a snap, which appears over the title on the same poster as this one, which is below the title. It's as real as the feelings you feel.
I mean...
yeah, right? It's kind of a lot of wah, wah, wah. Well, here, finally, we've got our last one, which I'm kind of a fan of myself. We've got fight, die, love, as you wish.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah. But even though there's a lot of spoilers in those taglines, it still may not be the best description. So let's go to Colin for our 60-second synopsis.
All right. When her one true love, Wesley, is killed by pirates, the beautiful Buttercup resigns herself to be the wife of Royal Dingus, Prince Humperdinck. Before the wedding can take place, however, Buttercup is abducted by a trio of rogues, Fezzik the Giant, Spanish Swordmaster Inigo, and their inconceivable leader, Vizini, who've been hired by the prince to kill his wife and incite war by framing the nearby kingdom of Gildor. But little do they know they are being pursued by the man in black. No, not Johnny Cash, but Wesley returned. After besting all three of her captors, Wesley reunites with Buttercup, and true love, while delayed, may now have the chance to prevail. Will Wesley and Buttercup be able to outrun Humperdinck and live happily ever after? Will Inigo find the six-fingered man and avenge his father's death? Does anybody want a peanut? Let's find out on another episode of I Used to Like This One.
Yeah.
My autocorrect kept putting Inigo as Indigo. And I didn't.
Right. Yes, I had that same problem. Yeah, this is one of those movies for me. This came out right around my 9th birthday. And that was what my birthday party was that year, was me and my friends went to see The Princess Bride in theaters, West Edmonton Mall. We were in that theater that used to be in the food court at West Edmonton Mall. And yeah, me and my buddies that went to see this. And I remember, because this is kind of a time before you could just look up, you know, what's good about a movie, what's bad about a movie. I remember my mom making phone calls about this movie to make sure that it was something that would be okay for a bunch of 9-year-olds to be taken to. And the only thing she was told was that, well, the eel scene might be a little bit intense for them. Other than that, I think overall it's pretty good. And I mean, I've got a lifelong love of this movie, and watching it again this week, man, it's still one of my top five of all time. It's got to be. This movie is so great. But that's where it started for me, was back when I turned 9 years old. So I guess I was one of the only people that gave it that $32 million.
Yeah, there you go.
But what about you, Colin? What's your history with The Princess Bride?
Yeah, so everyone will remember a few episodes back how I gushed nonstop over Fast and the Furious. But if my love for Fast and the Furious is a 1, my love for The Princess Bride is 100.
Oh, wow.
It is by far my favorite movie of all time. It's the first movie that I ever remember watching.
Okay.
When I was, I don't know, old enough to have memories, I guess. It was one of like 4 or 5 movies that we owned.
Yeah.
And on VHS. And I remember just watching it constantly. Mostly the sword fight scene. Like, I've probably seen that sword fight scene at least of like 10,000 times. Like, I'll just go on YouTube sometimes even now and watch it. But
yeah.
I don't know. This movie, it's kind of funny even doing the research for it this week about how it's meant to be kind of a fairy tale satire and all this stuff. Like, I never picked up on any of that when I was a kid. It was just an awesome story.
Yeah.
With cool characters. And yeah, I've loved it for as long as I can remember.
Okay, well, let's get into The Princess Bride. Directed by Rob Reiner and also produced by Rob Reiner and Andrew Scheinemann. And it's written by William Goldman, who wrote the book. Have you ever read the book?
No, I started reading it. But what happened is, have you read it?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Okay, so
It's been a long time since I've read it, but I have read it.
Okay, so what happened to me was I bought it and I started reading it. And then I didn't realize it's written in a way that it's not. He's rewriting a fake book.
Yeah.
That's how it's being written.
Yeah.
And so I was so confused because I was like, oh, well, I want to read the original, like, S. Morgenstern Princess Bride or whatever. And so then I, like, hunted for this book that I only recently found out doesn't exist at all. And so now I'll have to go back and actually read the William.
Yeah, I want to read the unbastardized version. Yeah. That's right, yeah. I don't want this weird Cliff's Notes version. Yeah, I read that this was Rob Reiner's favorite book from his childhood, which is why he pushed so much to be involved in this. I was surprised that William Goldman has a fairly impressive screenwriting resume, and it caught me totally by surprise. Like, he's the writer on Papillon and Stepford Wives, All the President's Men, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Misery, Chaplin. Like, I had no idea. Like, I knew him as the author of this book. I figured he was just a novelist. I didn't realize that he had this huge screenwriting resume. But
yeah.
I do remember, though, with the book, that I enjoyed the book because it was so accurate to the movie,
okay.
which is rare when it comes to some sort of adaptation. And there are some things that were different. I don't remember the book well enough, but I remember there were a few things that were different. But overall, yeah, ultimately, it's pretty close.
Okay. Yeah, I look forward to. I was on Audible the other day, and I was going to see if there was a audiobook version that I could listen to, and there is one that's narrated by Rob Reiner, but it has some of the worst. It has some of the worst reviews I've ever read.
Oh, because okay.
It's from, I think, around the time that the movie came out, and obviously, okay. Like, audiobook narration is not what it is today, so it's, like, lots of people commented that he, like, repeats lines or, like, has to stop and cough and stuff. And
oh, wow.
Like, I was like, no thanks. And it's, like, an abridged version of the book, so it's not even, like, the true. So I was just, I'll pass on that. Well,
yeah, I mean, I'd love to hear it narrated by Peter Falk the whole way through, because some of the things he does when he's narrating, like, my favorite has to be when he stops his story partway through and says to his grandson, she doesn't die here, you know, when it's the eel scene.
Yeah.
And then you've got the whole part where he's like, okay, where was I? The eels were approaching, and just the way that he tries to catch up. Yeah. I could listen to Peter Falk reading a whole version of this.
Oh yeah.
But okay, let's open up our movie. It opens on one of my favorite gimmicks, no music, just the sound of the grandson coughing. I love the use of grandson and grandfather. Like, the fact that they're never named, they're just grandson and grandfather, and just the way that they're used in this movie, I think they're used just enough in this movie.
Yeah.
To get the point across, but without, like, yeah, leaning too much into that aspect of it.
I think that they're used perfectly for... It's weird that no one else... Maybe they haven't done it because it would be such a blatant ripoff of The Princess Bride, but it's a really cool way to get into a fantasy movie.
Mm-hmm.
Especially a movie like this where it's... Like, I can't imagine this movie without that aspect of it.
Yeah.
Like, if it was just the story of what happens played out, I feel like it might not have been as good. There's something about a story being told and those little interludes, like you mentioned with Peter Falk, like even at the end when he's going to describe the kiss and he's like, oh, you don't want to hear that. And he just...
Yeah, okay, the end, yeah, the it's all like, done, yeah.
There's just something about it that it like, takes you get so hooked on the story. And you get kind of taken out of it at just the right times to make you want, like, you're like the grandson, like, you want more, like,
yeah.
I don't know, it's weird.
Yeah. And so, grandson and grandfather, of course, played by Fred Savage and Peter Falk. Man, did I enjoy, I mean, you say blatant ripoff, I do enjoy Deadpool 2 when they did their Once Upon a Deadpool, and oh, yeah. Using Fred Savage for that. There are times that I would prefer to watch Once Upon a Deadpool over Deadpool 2, just because this whole Fred Savage narrator aspect just adds so much to it.
Really?
And maybe it's the joy, you know, that The Princess Bride brings me. Maybe it's that retro joy, but yeah, I do like me some, you know, Once Upon a Deadpool. Have you seen that one?
I haven't, no.
Oh, okay. It's fun how it's done, yeah. Because otherwise, it's like the movie is the same. They've just cut out some of the violence, pretty much, right? So
yeah, that was ultimately why I didn't end up going to watch it, because I thought like the Fred Savage stuff was just going to be kind of like a one-off scene at the beginning. I didn't realize that it was that same way where it was throughout the whole movie.
Yeah, surprisingly, it does come back a few times. Yeah, because I thought the same thing. So one thing I never realized about this movie is that it takes place near Christmas. I've never understood why he has like this Santa hanging in his room as a decoration, or why the book is wrapped. But when the mom opens the curtains, there's snow and lights. So I mean, add this to your Christmas watch list, kids.
Yeah, I never picked up on that.
Yeah, especially the Santa Claus. I've just always thought it was bizarre. It's like, why does he have Santa all year round? I guess the kid really likes Christmas. I don't know. But yeah, I also just, I love the whole relationship between like the grandson and grandfather. The he pinches my cheeks. Well, maybe this time he won't. And then like the look on Fred Savage's face when he gets his cheeks pinched, like priceless.
there's also just something so heartwarming about a grandpa coming to read to his sick grandson.
Yeah.
And just how that would never happen. I don't even know if it would have happened then, but it would most surely never happen now.
Yeah. Yeah, probably not. Yeah, is this a kissing book? Yeah, and I mean, it seems like a long book to get read in one day, but hey, they managed to do it.
Yeah, he's a speed reader, or he was like kind of abridging while he went on his own.
Oh, he might have done that too, yeah. And I read that Fred Savage never met Carrie Elwes. I don't know if that fact included like on the red carpet. I don't know if they've never met, but yeah, they never met on the set at least.
Yeah, because they were filmed like completely separately.
Yeah.
Which I feel like would be an odd, that would be weird to be like, yeah. Oh yeah, we were in that movie together, but we never met.
Yeah. Oh, that would be so bizarre. Yeah, like, I even read the fact that most of this movie was filmed in England, except for one scene. And it's at the very end there where grandson says, hey, grandpa, can you come back and read that tomorrow? And it's the close-up of Peter Falk turning around and saying, as you wish. That scene was a pickup that they did in Los Angeles, and it's the only scene in the entire movie that's not filmed in England. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, I guess they had to get that one right. Oh, well. Got to finish on As You Wish. Yeah.
But it is a nice touch.
Yeah.
Is Fred Savage, he would have already been doing Wonder Years by this point, right?
I think so.
I can't ever remember when that show took place. I feel like it was mid-80s to mid-90s, but...
Yeah, like, it must have been. I'm even trying to remember when The Wizard was. The Wizard was after this, I think. Wonder Years ran from 88 to 93, so no, he wasn't in it yet.
Oh.
Yeah. There was Little Monsters. I remember Little Monsters.
Yeah.
Huh. I guess this is what got him the part on Wonder Years then.
Yeah, I was just trying to think where this is in his career. Is this like... Because I think he's credited as a special appearance in the credits. So I was wondering if maybe it was like, oh, like it was this kind of like a cool stunt casting thing. Or if this was his kind of debut.
Yeah, it feels more like this was his debut.
Yeah.
I mean, they say the same thing for Robin Wright, introducing Robin Wright, but she actually does have a couple screen credits before Princess Bride, I noticed, when I was looking at her.
Hmm.
So, but, and they introduce her as the Princess Bride. I don't understand why they don't call her Buttercup, because that's really the only thing we actually know her as in this movie.
I thought that was odd, too.
Yeah, but I do want to get into the fairy tale aspect, but Colin... Before we leave the grandson's room and start looking at the fairy tale.
I was going to say, I wanted to point out that almost every time I've watched this movie from the time I was 4 years old, I can't help but admire the just litany of awesome toys that are on that grandson's headboard.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I think we need to address the most important thing that those toys represent. This is the only location in the movie with product placement, so it's time to do a rundown of Sponsorship Corner.
Let's get to it.
So, always on a lookout for product placements in movies. This one isn't very big, but we've got a few. This week, The Princess Bride is brought to you by the game Hardball by Accolade for the Commodore 64. Cheetos, the Chicago Bears, Cubs, and White Sox, which I find odd because, like, with the Cubs and White Sox, isn't that kind of like the Yankees and Mets?
Yeah, you can't.
You're usually not fans of both.
You can't like both, no.
Yeah, okay.
I was listening to somebody talk about that recently. It's like a North Side, South Side thing in Chicago.
Okay. We've got BMX Bicycles, Garfield, Captain America, Mattel, specifically He-Man, the Hudson's Bay, which is Grandpa's mug, and the DC comic Tales of the Legion of Superheroes, number 320. And this has been Sponsorship Corner. I really got a kick out of that when Grandpa starts drinking out of the mug. And I'm like, that looks like the Bay, right? But they're in the States. Why is he drinking out of a mug that's the Bay? And sure enough, in the fun facts that I read, it did say that, oh yeah, Grandpa's got a little nod to Canada with his Hudson Bay mug. I don't know why. I don't think any of the filmmakers or Peter Falk, I don't think any of them are actually Canadian, but I guess they like a good Hudson's Bay mug.
Maybe it's like a nod to the Commonwealth, filming in England.
Oh, maybe. Okay. Okay, let's get into our fairy tale. And I think the love story is probably the place to kick it off, because that's what we're first introduced to. I mean, it is a kissing book after all. So we've got Wesley, the man in tights, or the man in tights, Wesley, the man in black, played by Cary Elwes, who was in Saw, and Robin Hood, Men in Tights, and Buttercup, the Princess Bride, played by Robin Wright. Robin Wright, she's a weird one for me, because anything I've ever seen her, I can't ever see Buttercup again. I don't know why.
I know, I was thinking that exact thing, because my wife recently was rewatching House of Cards.
Uh-huh.
So I've seen her face, like, now quite a bit. And then I was watching this movie, and I was like, she does not look... It's like, you have to look really hard. I don't know if it's just because she was so young, mm-hmm. but you have to look really hard to see her, to see Robin Wright now in Buttercup.
Yeah, or Jenny from Forrest Gump, or, like, Wonder Woman. Like, her character in Wonder Woman, it's like, I don't see it. And, you know, yeah. In Wonder Woman, you're on a horse. Like, I should be able to make that connection. And I anything else Robin Wright's ever been in, I just don't see her. Like, I don't know if it's because she's a chameleon or whether there's just, I don't know. Maybe it's just something about her look as Buttercup. Like you said, maybe she's young. I don't know.
Yeah. Actually, I was super excited a few Edmonton Expos back because Cary Elwes was there. So I got to meet him in air quotes.
Oh yeah,
which was interesting. He's like, he must be like agoraphobic or something like that. He's one of, like, you see this very rarely, but he had like his own sectioned off booth on the autograph floor with like a wall of sheets around it so that you couldn't see into him. You had to like go into this section to go and get your autograph and talk to him or whatever.
Okay,
but yeah. It was one of those times where I was so excited. This always happens to me when I go to these expos, but I was so excited to meet him, obviously, this being one of my favorite movies. And I had just finished reading his book about the making of The Princess Bride, and says that's what I was going to get him to sign.
Okay.
And when I went up there, I was just like, what do you say? What do you say to this guy in like 2 seconds? I was just like, oh, it's nice to meet you. I love this movie. And I love your movie. And he's like, I'll never forget his response, because he just looked at me and was like, we have fun. And I was like, okay, thanks. Wow. Bye.
Okay.
here's my $50 for your autograph. Thank you.
Yeah, I know. Like, I know I went to see Kevin Smith in concert at one point, one of his evenings with Kevin Smith, and I decided to wait in line to ask him a question. But it's just one of those, how do you ask him a question that he hasn't already been asked 1,000 times along this tour? So I ended up asking him a question about whether he had any more animation in the future, because I love Clerks and Censored. But anyway, but he's not in this movie. what was Cary Elwes there promoting? Just being Cary Elwes, or was there also something? Because I didn't realize this, but he has a Wonder Woman connection as well.
Oh, really?
He was cast in that Adriana Padalecki or whatever. The one that...
Oh, the...
It was supposed to be a series that didn't end up taking off. But apparently he had a part in that one.
Yeah.
So both he and Robin Wright have this Wonder Woman connection.
Yeah, I think he was just there at the time for... Just with it was mostly like just because of his Princess Bride affiliation. I think it was around...
Okay.
It was around the time of the 30th or 25th anniversary, maybe. So I think I think they might have had a bunch of them. Like, I think Wallace Shawn was there as well, and that kind of thing.
No, that's just inconceivable.
Yeah, exactly. I feel bad for Wallace Shawn, because I read in that Cary Elwes book that he gets it the worst when it comes to the fans, because whenever he does basically anything, fans are just like, oh, that's inconceivable. That's like, that would be quite annoying.
Well, yeah, like Wesley years. I mean, I guess you might be able to come up to him and say as you wish, but like, both Wallace Shawn and Mandy Patinkin must get it pretty bad too, with, oh, my name is Inigo Montoya, you killed my father.
Speaking like, of like how you're talking with Robin Wright, Mandy Patinkin's another guy who I do not see Inigo in anything I see him in now.
Yeah,
like when
no,
he was in Homeland
not.
Or when he's in some new show right now.
He was in one of my favorites, Dead Like Me. But yeah, okay. I know what you mean. Yeah, he was young and sexy in this. And then like, and then just like overnight, he turned into like a middle-aged man.
Yeah.
I read one alternate casting for Wesley was Christopher Reeve.
Oh, yeah.
and alternate castings for Buttercup, Uma Thurman, Courtney Cox, Meg Ryan. Apparently, Whoopi Goldberg tried to petition for the part, and so did Terry Shields on behalf of her daughter Brooke Shields, but Brooke Shields was turned down by Rob Reiner for being too much of a celebrity, I guess? Like, it might have been like casting a Kardashian, maybe? Well, I don't know if Brooke Shields was ever that huge. Like, I know she was big in the 80s, but I don't know if that's the right comparison as a Kardashian.
I don't have a good reference point for Brooke Shields, because she was kind of before my time.
Yeah.
I honestly can't imagine anybody else playing these characters.
The one that the author, William Goldman, wanted, though, was Carrie Fisher. That was his ideal choice, apparently.
For Buttercup?
Yeah. But, like, see, I mean, that's the thing, is I can see Carrie Fisher when she was still Princess Leia age.
Yeah.
Right? In the mid-80s, or, like, late 80s, she was no longer that, you know, cute, naive-looking... I don't know. Like, I think of The Burbs with Tom Hanks around this age, or Postcards from the Edge. You know, she looks more like a mom in the late 80s than she did in Star Wars or something.
Yeah, it's hard to... I was thinking, like, Meg Ryan on face value kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, America's Sweetheart.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I definitely can't imagine somebody having just, like, the ability to be a striking leading man... with also just the most insane comedic timing as Carrie Elwes for this role.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know anybody else who has that charm for that character.
Yeah, he's the right amount of badassery and... Is that a word? Sure, badassery.
Yeah,
I'll make that a word. But and charm. And I wonder how many people out there use As You Wish in place of I Love You. I feel like, you know, Ditto was probably used a lot after Ghost came out. I wonder how many people say As You Wish in their relationships at home.
Only like, I was gonna say, only just like cheese ball like nerds, because that's the people who watch this movie.
So when Wesley comes back into her life as the Man in Black, why does he keep up the ruse for so long? He threatens to backhand her at one point. Is he really just testing her loyalty to him? Why does he keep it up for so long?
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird that he seems so mad. He seems so mad that she's gone and, like, promised to marry somebody else. Yet he climbs up a cliff, sword fights a man, fights a giant.
Mm-hmm.
And all just to, like, rescue her. Just to turn around and be like, ugh, how could you?
Yeah. I don't understand why it's dragged out for so long, yeah.
It'd be interesting to think about, like, what his actual end game was if he didn't get pushed down the hill.
Yeah.
Like, was he just going to unmask and be like, voila, it is I, returned.
get her to his ship before revealing who he really is? Yeah, I don't know. It's something I've never understood.
Yeah.
But, I mean, and they also put in, like, they put so much stake in the power of true love in this movie, though. Like why didn't you wait? Well, it's been 5 years, dude. Like,
I guess one of the questions I've always had about this movie is, like, is it taking itself seriously or is it comedy? Like, it's very unclear, like, what is serious and what is meant to be, like, comedic.
Mm-hmm.
Because that line, it seems funny. It should be funny, but they take it so serious, which maybe that's what makes it funny, but it's hard to know if, like, the characters are taking it seriously.
Yeah, I'm not sure, because, I mean, there are some things that are so obviously jokes, mm-hmm. right? But a lot of it, kind of like a show like The Office, is it's not really... feeding you with jokes, and it's more the characters that are the funny things. Like, I even think about when Prince Humperdinck is sitting there talking about how swamped he is because he's got his country's 100th anniversary to organize, he's got a wedding to plan, a wife to murder, and a country to frame for it.
Yeah.
He's swamped, you know? And so it's just, you know, it's one of those where what he's saying isn't necessarily funny, but it's how he's saying it, and it's the character himself taking it so seriously and matter-of-factly that, I mean, maybe that is what the joke is here, because it's not an all-out comedy. this isn't something that's trying to be like Robin Hood Men in Tights or a Blazing Saddles would be. Like, it is still taking itself seriously to an extent, because it's not one of those things where all of a sudden they're going to get into a car at one point, you know, yeah. Because, you know, at least they didn't go that route with it, like, and go completely parody or completely, you know, spoof movie.
Yeah, could you imagine if they pulled the Blazing Saddles at the end and they just all rode their horses and then got in a car?
Oh, yeah, that would have been the worst. Oh, man. Do you think the love story is a little rushed in this movie, though? Because, like, they kind of breeze over it all in the beginning, like, you know, with the whole, he realized that when he was saying, as you wish, he was actually saying, I love you, and the, fun boy, get me that picture. Like, as you wish. But I just, I feel like, I don't know, like, how much time do you think passed in that beginning before he went off to sea?
That's what I was going to ask, because to me, it seemed like they were together for at least a couple years, to me, before he left.
Okay.
And so if that's the case, then, like, him coming back, and then I also feel like it's probably only been maybe 2 or 3 months that he's been gone when he comes back.
Yeah, but he says 5 years when he comes back. It's the opening, because it's always whole story about, I'm sure to likely kill you in the morning and all that, and that went on for 3 years, and then they docked, and then he came on, you know, the Dread Pirate came on.
Right.
So that part is 5 years. It's the opening bit, the whole as you wish montage in the opening, though. It, like, I get this feeling like it's only a couple of months before he goes off, like, because if it was a couple of years in that beginning part, they would have already been married, probably.
Living in sin, or maybe she, maybe her. We don't really know much about her family.
No.
So, like, no. I don't know what, like, is Wesley her farm boy, or is he the family's farm boy?
Yeah, I guess that's something that's never been clear to me either. What kind of aristocrat is she? Like, there's obviously a reason why the prince would choose her.
Yeah.
Even though she's a commoner, they do say she's a commoner, but the prince would choose someone that had some sort of status of nobility, I'm sure. I don't think it's just based on looks, but you never know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But that could also be, like, the satire part of, like, in fairy tales. It's, you know, love at first sight, and that's kind of the whole story is true love conquers all and all that stuff. So it doesn't matter how long you've been together, how long you've been apart, like, if you're truly in love, then everything will work out.
Yeah.
But,
well, I do like that she ends up learning her lesson the first time, though, because at the wedding later, when Humperdinck says, I killed him myself, then why is there fear behind your eyes? You know, this time it's like, no, I am waiting for my true love this time.
Yeah,
because he will be back. Even though someone has straight up, it's not just a case of being missing, someone has straight up admitted to killing him. But nope, he'll be back. We're in a land of fairy tales.
She can feel it in her heart.
Yeah. Now, how about our villains? We have Prince Humperdinck, played by Chris Sarandon, and Count Rugen, played by Christopher Guest. I read that although he plays a count, Christopher Guest is actually a baron in real life.
Baron of what?
Specifically, he's the fifth Baron Hayden - Guest of Sailing in Essex in the peerage of the United Kingdom, whatever any of those words mean. I don't know. Baron of Sailing, I guess. A fifth Baron. I don't know what any of that means. And of course, Vizini, played by Wallace Shawn, who was Rex in Toy Story. I don't necessarily count the other two guys as villains, though, because they end up good.
Yeah.
You know, like, they're thugs with their own agendas.
Muscle for hire. They're just doing a job.
Yeah. Yeah, because we even see that Fezzik takes another job at one point when he becomes part of the Brute Squad. So, And of course, those two are Inigo Montoya, played by Mandy Patinkin, and Fezzik, played by Andre the Giant. Alternate casting of Vizini, though, I read that Danny DeVito was up for the part.
Oh, yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. Well, and for Fezzik, originally, it was supposed to be Arnold Schwarzenegger, because they had been trying to develop this movie for several years already, but by the time it was made, Arnold Schwarzenegger was too big a star, and therefore too expensive for this little independent movie.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Liam Neeson auditioned, but was told that at 6'4", he was too short. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was offered the role, but the shooting interfered with his NBA season. And Richard Kiel, who we talked about in Happy Gilmore, was also considered. So those were also all possibilities for Fezzik. But I like Andre.
I'd read that Lou Ferrigno is also considered for Fezzik.
Oh, I didn't come across kind of like, that one.
If you couldn't get Arnold Schwarzenegger, why wouldn't you have gone with the Hulk?
Yeah.
Andre is ultimately obviously the best choice, but
yeah.
I'm shocked they didn't give Lou Ferrigno a shot.
Mm-hmm.
I find that the more I watch this movie, as I get older, Humperdinck and Rugen stand out more to me. I used to just mostly pay attention to Wesley and the three there, like Vizzy, yeah. Fezzik, and Inigo. But watching it now, I just even this the past time I watched it, I found Rugen and Humperdinck have some of the best lines and the best moments in the entire movie.
Yeah, they've got some really good stuff.
The whole beginning part where they're chasing, where they're kind of like on the heels of the other two groups.
Yeah,
is so funny when he's talking about how, like, one of my favorite lines in the entire movie is when Humperdinck's talking about, like, well, like, it looks like she's been abducted from people from Gilder, and he's like, if any harm should come to her, I will be very put out. And I'm just like, so good. So funny.
Okay, so, well, when they're tracking Buttercup, how do they get to the top of the cliffs, though?
Yeah, I have no idea. That makes...
With horses.
That makes no sense. They just Adam West Batmaned it and just, like, climbed their horses up the side of the mountain.
Yeah. One of the moments that I do love out of those two is, like, when they get to the fire swamp and it's the whole surrender scene. Very well, I accept. But then we get the, do you promise that no harm will come to him? And Count Rugen goes, or is it the prince or Count Rugen that goes, what was that? Like, but you've got both Wesley and the prince that go, what was that? What was that? Yeah, just, yeah.
So good.
Yeah. In that scene, I read that Cary Elwes actually told Christopher Guest to hit him in the head, and it was a little too hard, and production had to be shut down for the day so that he could go to the hospital.
Cary Elwes actually suffered a lot of injuries on the set of this movie. I think on the very first day of shooting, he sprained his ankle really bad.
Well, I read what that was.
I can't remember from the book what it was, but
it was an ATV accident, because Andre the Giant was given an ATV to get around set because his back was so jacked by this point,
yeah,
that he was having trouble moving around. So he convinced Cary Elwes to drive the ATV for him, and like a rock got stuck under the clutch or something like that, and he lost control and ended up twisting his ankle in a ATV accident with Andre the Giant.
Yeah. Yeah, so, like, you can see, there's a couple of scenes where you can see he's not walking properly. The most notable one is after him and Buttercup fall down the hill, and they see Prince Humperdinck on top coming for them, and they run into the fire swamp. He's doing this, like, weird, like, hop skip.
Yeah, but see, I mean, of all the places, though, to actually have that injury, that's the perfect moment.
Yeah,
you just rolled down the hill. You didn't have to do this weird little hop skip. But yeah, at the top of the hill as well, that's why he sits down really weird with the one leg stretched out. Yeah, because he's nursing that ankle there, too.
Yeah, funny.
I didn't realize that until this viewing either. Like, I didn't know about that injury. I'm going to have to read that book. I didn't know that book existed.
It's awesome. It's one of the, like, especially if you love Princess, but it's, like, a very good, it's like a documentary, basically, but it's a very good kind of behind-the-scenes explanation of what was going on. And every now and then they have, like, other people from the cast will write, like, a little chapter, like, a little snippet to kind of cap it off and that kind of thing. So that was really cool, too.
Well, I read a biography about Chris Farley, which was the whole book was arranged that way, where it was all interviews from other people that the author had threaded together to make this story. But it was all just a book of quotes.
Okay.
But it told the story through the eyes of all the people that were in Chris Farley's life. And it was really interesting to read that. So that's a really neat storytelling convention.
Yeah, for sure.
I know in The Pit of Despair, when the albino first comes out, I thought it was Robbie Coltrane.
Robbie, I don't even know who that is.
That's Hagrid.
Oh, yeah, I can see it.
In the eyes, I thought it was him, sure. Right?
Hagrid has such a big beard, it's hard to imagine what his I don't even actually think I know what his actual face looks like.
Oh, he's in, like, the movie In Bruges. He doesn't have a beard in Bruges, I think, which is a Colin Farrell movie.
Oh, yeah, I just looked him up. Yeah, totally. He could have totally been that guy.
I read with the albino, though, that the actor, he had an allergic reaction to the contact lenses he had to put in. And so he doesn't watch this scene. He doesn't like watching this scene because it brings back, like, actual physical pain for him when he thinks about it or something.
Wow. Yeah. I enjoy the Miracle Max stuff with Billy Crystal quite a bit as well.
Yeah.
All that with... I can't remember what his wife's name is, but...
Valerie, Carol Kane. Carol Kane plays Valerie. Yeah, Max and Valerie. Yeah, which are actually the names of William Goldman's parents. So Miracle Max and Valerie, yeah, they were named after his parents. But yeah, they were really good. And just like a nice little bit of comic relief in the movie, because like this is the part where the movie kind of gets dark, because like the Count gets very sinister at one point when he's doing all his machine testing. All of a sudden he's very sinister, and you got the part where the prince comes down and like just straight up murders Wesley.
Cranks it to 50.
Yeah, and then you get to Miracle Max and it's like, oh, okay, this is the light part of the movie. The chocolate coating makes it go down better.
Yeah, it's almost the point of the fire swamp when they get captured in the fire swamp, to me is almost where the actual movie starts.
Yeah.
Everything else is so fast paced and it's like adventure, 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 sword fight, quotes, eels, blah blah, and then the movie actually slows down. It's like the part where you actually get some exposition happening.
Yeah.
You get drunk Inigo, which is probably one of the best parts of the entire movie, with Fezzik. Like, I think that the relationship between Fezzik and Inigo is the best part of this entire movie.
Oh, that would have been a great spin-off movie.
Oh yeah.
The adventures of Inigo and Fezzik, yeah.
Yeah. Like just the point where Fezzik is trying to sober him up by finally like just dunking his head into different barrels of water until finally like enough. So good.
Yeah,
I love it.
Well, and they end up with some of the great lines too, like, because when they do finally, you know, they get to the top of the castle and they're trying to bring Wesley back to life, where it's just the whole banter back and forth between them, where it's, you know, oh, well, we have my steel, his strength, and your brains. What I wouldn't give for a wheelbarrow. Hey, what did we do with that wheelbarrow? Well, why didn't you list that among the assets? Or the Holocaust cloak? I don't even know what a Holocaust cloak is, but Miracle Max said it fits so nice that I could keep it.
I love that when Inigo's trying to like assess the situation, and he's like, how many of them are there? And he's like, I don't know, 30? And he's like, how many do you think you could take? I don't know, maybe 10? But he has to count on his fingers. Yeah. At least 20 for me. Even on my best day, I could not do it.
We should probably mention that Mandy Patinkin is not Spanish, by the way. Even with quoting him there, realizing that you slip into a Spanish accent when you can't quote his lines without the Spanish accent. But yeah, he is definitely not Spanish, which might be the only problematic aspect of this movie. If we want to go back
what
and look
is
at that,
he? What is he?
He's Jewish and Russian.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Meh. It's like, I mean, it's not like he's doing blackface or anything like that.
I suppose so.
It's not, yeah. I don't know if that's problematic. It probably is. I just probably don't see it.
Because there's just too much love for this movie, right?
I will err on the side of it's probably a problem.
You know, Colin, we're 50 episodes in. You know, we're talking about the bad guys. I think we need to do one of our favorite segments for our 50th episode celebration. I think we need to do some I Used to Like This One Piece theater.
Nice. Let's do it.
So what I've sent to you just perfectly highlights some of the great lines that happened in this movie between one of our villains and the hero of the movie. We're jumping to the end here. I don't know. Who do you want to be in this case? Do you want to be Humperdinck or do you want to be Wesley?
Who do I want to be? You know what? I'll be Humperdinck.
Okay.
I'll let you be the leading man.
Okay. Let me butcher a British accent.
Well, you could always Kevin Costner it and just fade in and out. Fade in and out.
There we go.
Whenever you feel like. All right.
First things first, to the death!
No, to the pain.
I don't think I'm quite familiar with that phrase.
I'll explain, and I'll use small words so that you'll be sure to understand, you warthog-faced buffoon.
That may be the first time in my life a man has dared insult me.
It won't be the last. To the pain means the first thing you lose will be your feet, below the ankles, then your hands at the wrists, next, your nose.
And then my tongue, I suppose. I killed you too quickly the last time, a mistake I don't mean to duplicate tonight.
I wasn't finished! The next thing you lose will be your left eye, followed by your right.
And then my ears. I understand, let's get on with it.
Wrong! Your ears you keep, and I'll tell you why. So that every shriek of every child at seeing your hideousness will be yours to cherish. Every babe that weeps at your approach, every woman who cries out, "Dear God, what is that thing?" will echo in your perfect ears. That is what to the pain means. It means I leave you in anguish, wallowing in freakish misery forever.
I think you're bluffing.
It's possible, pig. I might be bluffing. It's conceivable, you miserable, vomitous mass, that I'm only lying here because I lack the strength to stand. Then again, perhaps I have the strength after all. Drop your sword. And have a seat. Yes! I used to like this One Piece theater. I figured one of our favorite movies, one of our favorite segments, we had to make sure that we got one in there for episode 50.
How could we not? That's a good one too. You vomitous mass. I need to use that more in my everyday insulting.
Okay, well let's go back and just let's touch on those three big things though that you jumped over. The fire swamp is where the story begins, but let's talk about that sword fight.
Yes.
Because I mean, come on. Like you said, you'll watch just that sword fight.
That sword fight is just, it's everything.
Yeah.
It starts, I love just the way it starts even, by, you know, they cut the rope, and Wesley's on the wall, and Inigo's getting impatient, and he's trying to offer him help, and he refuses it, and finally he does. And then, when he comes up, and, you know, he gives him time to, like, catch his breath and shake the rocks out of his boots.
I've never understood those rocks, those giant rocks. But yeah, I love the respect. There's just the honor shown where it's like, no, get your breath.
Yeah.
I'll finish you in a second. I want you fully breathing.
Yeah. I feel like Wesley almost changes immediately as a character the minute his mask comes off.
Yeah.
Like, as the man in black, he's almost Batman.
Yeah.
Like, he's just 20 steps ahead. You know, he's figured out you're already left-handed, so he's gonna be left-handed. He's got all the swagger of... There's so many things in the scene, even, like, when he throws the sword, then he does the little gymnastic flip there.
Yeah.
I remember when I was hiking the West Coast Trail, the very last thing, you have to climb down this probably, like, 40-foot ladder.
Okay.
Onto the beach, so I had my walking poles and I didn't want to carry them down with me while I climbed the ladder. So I just tossed them to the beach below. And I was so proud that they just stuck in the sand, nice. Just like Wesley's sword in The Princess Bride.
Yeah, like, I mean, I love how they, you know, he just hands over his sword to show him and everything like that. And they're showing respect for each other. Like, I'm sorry, any other movie, that would be... Hey, you just got your own dad's sword in your own gut because you handed over your only weapon. But I love the honor that they show each other.
Yeah, and I think in the book he goes through that, like, they did it all themselves. Like, the only time they used a stunt double, obviously, was for the
flip on the bar. The flip. Yeah.
Yeah, and they practiced for, like, weeks to get it down.
Well, and can you imagine that, you know, you have to learn sword fighting for a show and you have to learn how to be ambidextrous at it?
Yeah.
That's one of the most insane parts to me is the fact that, yes, they did all this fighting themselves and they had to do half of it left-handed.
Yeah.
I mean, that I don't know if I'd have the coordination for that.
No, I definitely would not.
And you touched on the left-handed. You think that Wesley picked up on the fact that Inigo's scabbard was on the wrong side? Like, do you think he intentionally chose? Because I was watching that, and I was impressed with the fact that he actually draws his sword, because his scabbard is, like, hanging behind his legs, and he draws it with his left hand. Wesley does. So I'm wondering, like, do you think that was a choice that he made of, oh, okay, this guy is bluffing me because his scabbard's on the wrong side?
Yeah, that's how I've always felt it. Like, I've always felt, like I said before, like, he's just ahead of the game. It's like he can't be beat because he knows exactly what to do to beat you already, like a chess master.
Yeah,
because
Inigo is so clearly about the game. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want it to go so quickly. That's why he's choosing to be left-handed.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, it makes me wonder whether Wesley just wanted to play the same game or whether he tracked, oh, okay, this guy's left-handed.
Mm-hmm.
Let me do that. Or this guy's pretending to be left-handed. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I've always loved that moment, though. I'm not left-handed either.
Yeah. I love that whole sequence when they're he's like, oh, you were very good. But I know something you don't know or whatever and all that. And he's like, and they go back and forth with that.
Yeah.
So much fun. My favorite part by far is the end of the fight when he has Inigo, like, he gets his sword out. Inigo's like, who are you? And Wesley says, no one of consequence. That's one of my favorite responses. And I've always kicked myself because I've looked for many a time to be able to use that in real life. And I've only had one opportunity, and yeah. I missed it because I didn't think of it till later. But I was working security at City Center Mall, and I came out at the end of my shift, and I was like on the corner of Jasper or something in 100th Street, and there was this guy there all drugged out, and he was weird, just standing on the corner waiting for the light to turn, and he just looked up at me with his eyes glazed over, and it was like, "Who are you?" And I think I just said. No one, man. Like, see you later. And afterwards, I was like, no one of consequence! No one of consequence!
Well, here's my real-world Princess Bride experience. As a bus driver, there was one time that I had this bus that, for some reason, was making this really weird sound. It was this high-pitched squeal that was coming around, coming out of the back, and I had a passenger come up to me and just say to me, "What is that noise?" And in my worst Wallace Shawn impression, I go, "Those are the shrieking eels! And they always get louder before they strike!" Blank stare. That's all I got. Like, she just stares at me like, "They always get louder before they strike." And I'm like, "Princess Bride, come on." She's like, okay.
That's kind of the problem with the Princess Bride, is that, like, you and I both love it, and I'm sure almost everybody we know loves it, but it's like you have to be in a certain group.
Yeah,
like I have found that it's like not I don't know if I call, not necessarily I would say like normal people, but it's like, but there's just like a distinct set of people, the type of people who go to comic cons or yeah. You know, are interested in most of the stuff that we're both interested in, theater people, like those are the type of people who've seen the movie. And I just realized I'm just surrounded by all those people, so I think that The Princess Bride is a bigger deal than it is, maybe. But, you mentioned before, like, the As You Wish thing, like, I actually remember, like, being like, oh, with my high school girlfriend, like, oh, I should tell her that, and then she'll, like, no. But she'd never seen the movie, and I was like, what a waste. Like, how, like, it's not fun if I have to get you to watch the movie just so you have the reference point.
Well, I did read that there are 7 As You Wishes in this movie. There's 7 As You Wishes, 5 Inconceivables, and 6 My Name is Inigo Montoya, You Killed My Father, Prepared to Dies.
That's probably like 15% of the dialogue.
Okay, so now he fights the giant after the sword fight, and I love how it's the same thing. All this wonderful banter between them. And the discussion about the difference between fighting one man and a dozen men. Like, I love that whole logic. But I read that there's actually a series of ramps built for that scene so that Cary Elwes wasn't actually hanging off of Andre the Giant because, as I mentioned earlier, his back was all messed up. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, all that stuff, he's kind of supporting his own weight on a series of ramps. Just like at the end when Andre the Giant catches Princess Buttercup, she was on wires for that.
Yeah, and too, I like how he's trying to be sportsmanlike.
Yeah.
Like how Vizina is like, oh, just wait for him to come around the corner, then take this rock and throw it at your head. And he throws it and hits the other rock. And he's like, I didn't have to miss.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, so you put down your rock, I put down my sword, and we try to kill each other like civilized people. I can kill you right now. I feel you have an unfair advantage. Well, it's not my fault I'm the biggest and strongest. I don't even exercise. Yeah. He was great in this movie. And I mean, from what I read, like, he was a great guy on set as well. Like, he was a very respectful guy. But I also find it interesting that, like, when we looked at that list of all the people that could have played Fezzik, they really didn't want someone that spoke English very well. The only person on that list was, like, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and, I guess, Liam Neeson. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, it's all these thick accents. But impressively, Andre the Giant didn't have to do any ADR work for this movie. Like, what happened, I guess, is Rob Reiner recorded all the lines on a tape, and Andre the Giant would walk around set listening to this tape.
Oh, yeah, I remember reading that, yeah.
Yeah, so he got all his lines on the day of, but he was so nervous about it, too. Some of his lines are hard to understand at times, but yeah, he did a pretty good job.
Like, Andre the Giant is, like, a legendary drinker.
Oh, okay.
To the point that he would just drink, like, barrels of wine. Huh. And I'm pretty sure he tells a story in the book about how he got, like, so drunk one night with the cast that he passed out in the hotel lobby, and nobody, like, he's massive.
Yeah.
And, like, nobody could move him.
Jeez.
And so they ended up having to, like, wait till the next day or something like that.
Huh.
There's also another story about how the, there was something that happened with the little person who played, is that what we call them?
Played the R-O-U-S? Yeah.
Yeah.
I read about that, too. He got pulled over the night before or something like that. And the cop had trouble believing that he had to be in a rat costume the next morning or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. That's a good scene, too, in the fire swamp. The R-O-U-S's, rodents of unusual size, for anybody who doesn't know.
Here's one of my questions, though, about that scene, though, is, okay, they're walking through the swamp, they find the fire things, they find the lightning sand, and impressive that he dives in head first into the lightning sand and manages to turn around somewhere in there. But when he comes out, right, she's sitting there hugging him and coughing up sand, and he sees over her shoulder one of these giant rats staring at him.
Mm-hmm.
And then as they're walking away, he says that, well, we already know about two of the things, and she said, well, what about the R-O-U-S's? And he goes, ah, rodents of unusual size? I don't think they exist. And that's when it jumps at him. Was he just trying to protect her feelings and hoping that they would never actually come at him? Because you just saw one.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that would make sense. Like, he was just trying to play it cool. Like, oh, don't worry about it. You've already fallen into quicksand.
And then 2 seconds later, though, he's proven wrong. I understand the comedic timing behind it. I just don't understand whether it's something where he didn't actually, like, he was just trying to ease her mind or something.
Sorry, let's go back. Let's go back to Vizzini. I skipped over that again.
Yes, yeah. Let's talk about Vizzini.
I find it, like, I mean, I guess he's just toying with him, but he's, like, playing when he plays with the cups, and he does the, like, fake, like, forward back.
Yeah, no, I do love the battle of wits between them. Absolutely.
Yeah,
and the fact that he's, like, you know, Socrates, Aristotle, morons, and it's like, oh well, there you go, you just convinced me, you called them morons, you know, obviously. You know, hey, Colin, Einstein, ever heard of him? He's a moron. I'm a genius.
Yeah,
can't you tell?
I tried really hard to follow Vizzini's logic as he was reasoning through this time to see if it actually made any sense, but he's literally just like, I can't trust the cup in front of you, I can't trust the cup in front of me. Like, he never I never saw him actually reach a point where he figures it out, I guess, until obviously he makes his choice to switch the cups.
Yeah.
So clearly, somehow he believes that Wesley poisoned his cup.
Yeah. Yeah. He's still hoping that Wesley was giving something away or whatever. Yeah. Iocane powder, not real, I found out. But I love the introduction of Iocane, though, where he goes, I don't smell anything. Well, what you are not smelling is Iocane powder.
Yeah.
You know, I just, yeah.
Okay, so you have that set up. But then when Humperdinck comes, he smells it, and he's like, Iocane powder, I'd bet my life on it.
Yeah.
Based on what? It's gone. And it's smellless.
Well, I guess because he doesn't smell anything, there's no residual smell left.
I guess he's just judging because there's a dead man there and no smell on the thing that it was that type of poison. I guess that makes sense.
Because earlier at the top of the cliffs, like, he was tracking the footsteps of the battle, but he was smudging them all out at the same time. So, I mean,
I noticed that too.
And the winner went this way and the loser went this way. How do you know? Well, I guess, okay, that one might make a bit more sense because you would have followed the body print to the footprint. Okay.
Yeah,
that one makes more sense, but I don't know. He's a pro tracker. Who am I to question his methods?
Yeah. I also, I don't know, Vicini doesn't look Sicilian to me.
Yeah.
He also doesn't look like, I mean, I guess Sicilian is kind of, is like pseudo-Italian, I suppose.
Yeah.
He doesn't look Italian at all either. No.
Danny DeVito would have been the more appropriate choice.
Yeah. I was going to say, the one guy that I could, I don't know if he was a big thing at this point in time, but I could see Jason Alexander being a good Vicini.
Yeah. Yeah, but Seinfeld was 89. I don't think he was really anybody until Seinfeld, for the most part. It seems like they were still trying to get bigger stars. Like, I don't know how big, well, like, that's the thing. Maybe not. I don't, it's tough to say. Just, like, I know all these people, but it's probably because of this movie.
Yeah. I didn't know what any of these actors had done other than The Princess Bride until very recently.
Yeah.
Like, even now, when I see Cary Elwes show up and stuff, like, when I saw him in Saw, I was like, oh, that's that guy, or mm-hmm. what's he been in recently? I feel like I saw him in something recently.
The Life in Pieces, he ended up, he was like the, oh, yeah, the teacher, yeah, he was, the professor or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. They're kind of all just guy, and like I said, Mandy Patinkin he's unrecognizable to me.
Yeah.
Robin Wright, she's kind of like, I mean, she's done a lot of stuff, but she's kind of, Buttercup, unfortunately, is not like that big of a standout character in this movie.
No, I suppose she isn't.
She's kind of just around.
Yeah. She's the cookie-cutter damsel in distress, for the most part.
Yeah.
Like, we talked about that one scene in Robin Hood where Marion was just kind of standing around while the other two fought. Mm-hmm. At least there are some scenes, like, with the rats, where she is actually putting up a bit of a fight. She's not just standing there.
Yeah.
I read that the rats were voiced by Rob Reiner. He did all the sounds for them. And also that with Buttercup, when her dress catches on fire, that William Goldman was on set visiting and he ruined a take because he actually panicked when her dress caught on fire. And
so, oh, really?
Yeah.
Is Rob Reiner, does he play the Fezzik double when they ride out on the horses?
Oh, I don't know.
I know it's clearly not Andre the Giant because I was watching that scene when he first shows up with the four horses.
Yeah.
And looking at those horses and looking at him, and as side by side comparison, those horses look like donkeys to you. Like,
yeah, yeah. Your toes would be dragging. Yeah. I guess the climax of the movie then, once Wesley comes back to life and everything, I want to say that I love all the physical acting from Cary Elwes when he's coming back to life, like his head jiggle and and the twitching finger. Yeah.
even when Fezzik puts him on the knight and he's just laying there all splayed out.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how he managed to keep that effect of his legs looking so limp.
Oh yeah.
For so long.
Oh yeah, because there's also when they're pushing the wheelbarrow in the Holocaust, when they light Andre the Giant on fire and he's just kind of dragging along behind, being pulled along. Now light it.
Yeah. Well, Inigo's like wearing him as a backpack almost, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, just about. Yeah. Give me the key. I don't have a key. Fezzik, take his arms off. Oh, you mean this key?
I do also love the climactic battle with Inigo and Rugen. It's probably I think that's like the most actually like emotional point of the movie. When they have their final fight. I do like how when they first face off, Rugen just runs away. Mm-hmm. I love Inigo trying to get through the door and like calling Fezzik.
Fezzik! Fezzik, he's getting away! Yeah, and I love that he kills off Count Rugen with the exact same injuries that are inflicted on him.
Yeah.
One in each arm, one slash on each cheek, and then kills him with the gut shot.
Yeah.
Which are the exact same injuries that Count Rugen has given to him.
Yeah.
I want my father back, you son of a bitch.
Yeah, I love that.
Oh, still love that line, yeah.
Promise me anything I want in the world.
Yeah.
So good. I also noticed when Rugen first shows up with his henchmen, Inigo has some fancy like sword work that he does to kill all four of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, you could have easily taken 20 people.
Well, maybe it was just because of the limited size of the hallway when he takes care of them.
Yeah, it's like
right? they can't surround him.
It's like a Thermopylae type situation.
A hot something gate. Like that. Yeah. Yeah, and then, of course, at the end, yes, he's been in the revenge business for so long. Well, has he ever considered piracy? So that would have been a great sequel right there, is to jump into Inigo and Fezzik as pirates.
Oh, yeah. That would be so good. Someone has to make that movie. Like, you could do so much with those two characters. I feel like they kind of reminded me of in Thor Ragnarok, mm-hmm. like Korg.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like there's a movie to be made out of Korg and Meek.
Yeah, 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 quite possibly.
So good.
I mean, you know, we could go highbrow instead of Thor, though. We could be like, oh, they're Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, but yeah, they're Korg and Meek.
Yeah. I also don't understand the weird cut to Robin Wright, like, floating in the sky when she gets thrown to the horses.
Yeah, it must have been some very flowery language in the book, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, because, like, even the description of the last kiss, grandson's like, no, okay, you can read it, Grandpa. And it's just like, you know, of all the kisses that ever were, like, the top five kisses, and it's just, it's such a cheesy line describing this kiss that it's like, well, maybe her jumping out of the window in this weird slow motion with the music and billowing dress, maybe it was just how it was described in the book.
Yeah.
I don't know.
At what point does Wesley's ability come back?
Well, he does say that he's always been a fast healer.
Okay.
Yeah, sometime when he's lying on the bed, when she's kissing him.
Yeah.
Be careful. Funk. Which is actually the only kiss in the movie that the grandson does not have a comment on.
Yeah.
Is when she's kissing him on the bed.
Yeah.
Yeah, all the other ones they stopped the book for.
I mean, I guess we should go back. We didn't really talk about the shrieking eels, but I wanted to ask, like, did you find it to be scary? Was it scary when you went and watched it as a kid?
No, not really, because I knew it was coming. Maybe a little bit. There was one guy that was with us that was absolutely terrified.
Yeah.
But for me, it was okay. But at 9 years old, I mean, it was kind of the scariest thing I had seen on film at that point.
Yeah, I was going to say, I remember it being scary when I watched it. That was like the scary point of the movie to me.
Yeah, I mean, I like all that stuff in the boat, that's for sure.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I do like in the boat when he's like, how does Inigo say it when he's talking about like, he's like, were you expecting somebody? And then Vizzini's like, well, why, like, no. And then he, like, as an afterthought asks, like, why do you ask? And he's like, oh, no, like, it's just that somebody's following us. Like, it's no big deal.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, there we go. That's Princess Bride. Now, Colin, on IMDb, it scored 8.1 out of 10, has a Metascore of 77. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 97% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 94%. Man, does Rotten Tomatoes love this movie over IMDb. But, Colin, those are just numbers. Like a well-placed butt of the sword to the noggin. Hit us with some reviews.
All right. I'm going to start with this one from Google from a guy called A Chaotic Gay. I'm just going to double check. Yes, that's a gay, not guy. A chaotic gay named Chris. He gave it 5 out of 5 stars. And he says, this movie is funny and interesting, and as a person with a horrendously depressing world outlook, I can tell you that this movie distracts me from everything and just makes me laugh. Been a lifesaver in quarantine. It's supposed to be a cheesy romance, which I would normally either avoid like my life depended on it or burn violently, but this is different for me. I'm not sure why. If you hate cheesy movies or romance, then you probably wouldn't enjoy The Princess Bride, but I still love it.
I don't know. I mean, the whole romance part of it, I know that that's the whole undercurrent the whole time through, is that it's about true love and all that sort of stuff, but I really don't find it to be a super romantic movie anyway.
Yeah, I don't find the romance between Wesley and Buttercup to be a big driver of the movie.
Yeah.
I think what happens at that halfway point after the fire swamp is it becomes a lot more about Inigo getting his revenge, like avenging his father. And I find that to be a more emotional center of the movie, basically ramping up towards the end.
That's what it is he needs to recruit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're not going there to stop the wedding, even though he does make the comment of when we hear the scream that runs through the kingdom when he's dying. He makes the comment of, well, there's only one man that would scream like that because his true love marries another tonight. But how would Inigo know that about the man in black?
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't know.
They never had that discussion. Yeah.
I never thought about that. Interesting. Yeah. All right. Rotten Tomatoes, Matt G., 4.5 out of 5 stars says, a marvel of a movie that celebrates while simultaneously laughing at the absurdity of fantasy storytelling, managing the near impossible task of equal amounts cynicism and sincerity throughout. The pacing is remarkable, each scene moving breathlessly into the next like an exhaustively choreographed sword fight. Nearly every scene is perfect. Wine drinking, Inigo's revenge, Wesley's threatening speech to Humperdinck, even the framing in Savage's bedroom. One of the greatest children's films ever.
The framing in Savage's
Fred Savage.
Oh, okay. I was thinking about the bedroom scene at the end, the face off between Humperdinck and Wesley. That's what I was thinking was the Savage. He's just calling the prince a savage, but I get it now. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Joel H. 5 out of 5 stars says they don't make movies like The Princess Bride anymore. In fact, I don't think they made films like it before either. This film is one of a kind. It's an original, engaging story with clever dialogue and a host of engaging characters. The humor is subtle and plentiful, and it's sweetly heartwarming without ever getting too sappy. This is a fantastic tale of fencing, fighting, torture, revenge, giants, monsters, chases, escapes, true love, miracles, and everybody should see it. Oh, and if you haven't read the book, you should do that too.
I wonder if that guy's got a review over on Goodreads or something. And if you haven't seen the movie, you should do that too, is how he ends that one.
This is an unnamed reviewer, 5 out of 5 stars, says, the movie I've rewatched more than any other. Even more than any holiday or superhero movies or Star Wars, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, Pixar, or Studio Ghibli movies. It is not only a classic, but also the perfect movie, all caps. All movie creators should watch this to know what a good movie looks like before proceeding with their projects. I feel no need to explain myself if you've already seen it, and if you haven't, then there is something very wrong. And then finally, Rotten Tomatoes super reviewer Michael M. says, 5 out of 5 stars, a movie I grew up with. Watching it years later, it is really just a fantastic, well-rounded adventure film. The funny thing is, noticing as an adult, there are some elements that could be questionable, namely that the directing and music can be a bit basic and pedestrian, and there is an overall feeling of camp to a lot of it. I also never noticed before that the actual plot of the villain is a bit convoluted, but the thing is, none of that matters. In fact, it's almost part of the charm. The comedy works, the adventure works, the sense of fun just works. The camp is part of the charm, and all you need to know about the story is beat the bad guy and true love conquers all. It's a great introduction to adventure stories for kids, with just a bit of edginess, and watching it years later, it's just a damn entertaining movie.
I mean, he ended up mentioning the convoluted story, and for me, watching it this time, the story of the villain made more sense to me, I think, than the first time I watched this movie, where it's like, oh, they actually thought about the fact that the prince is, like, behind it all. And I don't think that makes it very convoluted. I think that might, I don't know. I just don't necessarily agree with that part of what he had to say.
Mm-hmm.
Right on. So yeah, we've got, let's just look at Rotten Tomatoes. We've got 97% and 94% from Rotten Tomatoes. Where does this fall for you, Colin?
Like 1,000%.
1,000%, yeah.
Like, watching it with a more critical lens, I do think there's some, just like tonally, I think it could have been a little bit cleaner.
Yeah.
But I find it so entertaining. I think it gets more entertaining to me the more I watch it.
Mm-hmm.
I think for the longest time, it's like you watch a movie like this with kid eyes and you don't really see kind of some of the more nuanced things, like I said before. Like, I never really noticed how funny Rugen and Humperdinck were. Like, even that scene that you were talking about earlier when they're outside the tree. Like, I never really even picked up on that until I watched it this time around.
Yeah.
Where I was really paying attention. And so, yeah, I think it's just a fun movie, and it just makes me feel nice.
Yeah.
It makes me feel good in my heart.
Yeah, 50 episodes in, I don't think I've given any movie 100% yet, but this would be the one for me. If I was going to give myself, if I was going to go 10 out of 10 on any movie, this is it. I've always loved this movie, and watching it this week, it was just, it felt so good to come home. I remembered everything about this movie, and I just enjoyed it that much more, because I may have noticed a couple of lines that I hadn't really picked up on the previous times that I've watched this movie. So, is it a perfect movie? No, it's not a perfect movie, but it's everything I want in a movie, and for enjoyment, it's 10 out of 10, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. That's The Princess Bride, and that's our show for this week. If you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is, well, tell your friends. Word of mouth is so important for a podcast. We're building this from the ground up, and we want everyone to tell somebody and just help us build our audience, because we started at zero. We didn't start with millions of followers like our rival Conan O'Brien, but if you want to go above and beyond and use science to help get us noticed, go to whatever app it is you you listen to your podcast on and give us 5 stars. Doesn't matter what you say, but those 5 stars, they just help drive up the charts and help us get noticed.
And be sure to check out our website, www.iusedtolikethisone.com. There you can find links to all of our podcast episodes, as well as our links to our social media. We have Facebook, we have Instagram, we have Twitter. Go on there, check out our memes, give us some comments, give us some likes, give us some shares, give us some follows, all that good stuff. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com. Drop us a line and let us know what movies you used to like, and then maybe you'll find us talking about it on our show.
And Patreon, if you want to be a financial supporter of this show, become an executive producer, just like Josh Blum, you can go to patreon.com/iusedtolikethisone and become part of our Patreon family. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band, Carter in the Capitals, anywhere you listen to music. Thank you for listening. And join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.